Well, there we go. All right, well, listen. Sunday afternoon, you just had a big lunch. What next? I know it. Well, this is dangerous stuff, ain't it? But you got to get up and move around and help yourself. But let me take it back to the notes. And I thought just before I go here, on page 37 it says, but it's not because I cut and pasted. On page, I don't know, the pagination's all fouled up because I do too much cutting and pasting. But there are some maps here. And then on the next page is a chart. And for what it's worth, this chart is just the days of the Passion Week, as I understand them, and it's pretty well understood, so the successive events of the week and so on. But I want to go back to Sunday, a day of Messianic presentation. And so if you go to page 7, and I'm not going to spend too much time with it, actually. Everybody got notes? I think they're in the back if you don't. But let's go back to what we were talking about this morning, that Jesus, about just 3 months before the Passion Week, the triumphal entry, which commences the Passion Week, had gone to Jerusalem. While he was there, he had claimed to be one with the Father. There was a threat against his life, and so he had made his way over into Perea. And while he was in Perea, first of all, those Pharisees had come trying to lure him back, and he said, I'm not going to fall for that, but I'll make you this promise. You're not going to see me until you welcome me as Messiah, until you cry out, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, which was, on the face of it, an unspeakably unlikely event. But then Jesus, a few days, weeks later, went to Bethany to minister to Lazarus, called him from the dead, and we said that there were these three results. Number one, Jesus was now a fugitive. There was a deliberate deliberate effort to get him arrested. Paul Meyer, M-A-I-E-R. Do you know that name? He's very much worth reading. Paul Meyer's a Christian historian and great student of the first century Roman world. And he tells, he insists that there are records. I've never seen them, but there are. We know that they would sometimes actually chisel wanted posters, as it were, throughout the land. They would, on wood plates and so on, they would have it. And it's very possibly they put out a notice that if anybody knew where Jesus was, they were to let him know so they could arrest him. So number one, he was a fugitive. Number two, of course, the whole city was abuzz with the issue. Was he going to come to the Passover? And thirdly, he takes himself to Ephraim. Now, I'm going to give you a map here. And let me just, you can see it. I've done it rather, well, I hope this will work across the room. But because, let me see what I got to do here. Now, look, Jesus goes to Ephraim. Ephraim, actually, there are three cities today which claim to be Ephraim, three modern cities. There used to be two, and a third one discovered here just a few years ago. The place, interestingly enough, that is remembered as Ephraim is a place called Ophrah, and seems to remember the name. And when you go there, there's a very early church, but on the wall of the church is a mural that's a modern mural of the raising of Lazarus, which is curious because you're in Ophrah, and that happened down in Bethany. But because in the New Testament, it says that after the raising of Lazarus, he went to Ephraim. But at any rate, what we know for sure is that Ephraim was right on the border of Samaria. Now, let me just walk you through this. And here's where I'm taking you. All right, let me make just dead sure we're on the same page. What I'm saying is that Jesus had made a promise to those Pharisees in Luke 13. It was a hideously unlikely promise. And yet we know that it came to pass. But how did it come to pass? Was it simple happenstance? It couldn't have been happenstance. How did it come to pass? And let me stop on one other thing here, just real quickly. You know, some years ago, I don't want to talk about this, but some years ago I got quite sick and should have died. But my wife saved my life. And the doctors wanted to take my spleen because they thought it would do it, and it wouldn't do it, so we didn't do that. I said, just to make the point, I still got my spleen, And sometimes I vent it. And I want to vent my spleen. I don't even know what that means, for heaven's sakes. But let me vent my spleen for just a minute. Because, listen, what's going to happen in the triumphal entry is that Jesus is going to ride into that town at Passover and be welcomed wildly as king. Now, you got to understand something, folks. This is a day when, number one, Rome is a fairly newly minted empire. You got to understand it. She doesn't have a long history as an empire. And she has swept through, I shouldn't say swept through. But over the last 150 years, she had conquered Macedonia. Then she had conquered Carthage. And she had become master of the Mediterranean world. And then she had swept into her control all these kings and kinglets and fiefdoms and so on. So there were people all over the Mediterranean world who could remember very well what it was like to run their own affairs, to be independent. You know what that means, by the way, very practically? If you mint your own coins, you collect your own taxes, and you have your own army. And they had been that. They'd been running their own affairs. There'd been plenty of problems, but now they are under the heavy heel of Rome. And it was heavy. Do you recall, by the way, Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees a vision in which he sees four empires. Remember, the Babylon is a lion, Persia is a bear, Greece is a leopard. What is Rome? Remember? It's a monster, indescribable, great iron jaws and claws. It devours its enemy, it claws them to pieces and so on. That's Rome, folks. There was nothing pleasant about being under the yoke of Rome. And so here's my point. For that reason, this rather newly minted, if you don't mind, empire that had subjugated so many different peoples and put them under such heavy, heavy tribute and so on, it just made their life pretty miserable. Rome was constantly threatened in one corner of the empire or another with sedition. Some remnant of the hitherto royal family would do a little calculus and say, I think Rome is busy elsewhere and their armies are too far off. I think we could rise up and throw them off and run our own affairs. And they wouldn't put up with it. This is why the Roman roads, and I like to say that this is my construct, but I think it's accurate. There were three rules that you had to live by if you were going to live under the Roman Empire. Number one is you don't raise your hand against Rome. Number two, if you do, we are going to put it down within hours. Maybe days, but probably hours. We're going to bring such massive force. We're not going to mess around. We're not going to play with. There's going to be no negotiations. We are going to stomp it out as swiftly and cruelly as we possibly can. So number one, you don't raise your hand. Number two, if you do, we're going to put it down in hours if possible, no more than days. But number three, the blood will run for months. You're going to pay villages within 100 miles that had nothing to do with it. They're going to pay. You're going to be hauled off, slaughtered, and slaves, and so on. So what I'm saying is that, and here's a curious thing. The one spot in the Roman Empire where they had more seditious empire, you know what I mean, sedition, rebellion, somebody trying to rise up and become a king and throw off the Roman yoke. The one spot in their whole empire where they had more seditious activity than anywhere else was Israel. And here's a curious reality. You really got to factor this in. It's a lot of history, forgive me. But the other interesting element is this, that the one spot in their entire empire where it was more difficult to put down the revolts than anywhere else was Israel. Israel, and you go there, and you're impressed with this. I like to say, Israel is like one big paintball arcade. You know what I'm saying? It's like it was just designed for guerrilla warfare. And the Romans know nothing but the phalanx, you know, this mighty power, you know. And they got these guys hiding in hills and digging secret caves and tunnels and drawing you in there and slaughtering you and suckering you into these deep veils and falling down and killing everybody and carrying off the equipment and so on. And it would take them years to put down these seditions. And so I'll go one further. The one season of the year when Israel was more prone to sedition in the other was Passover. Because what's going on at Passover? You're remembering a time when God delivered you from a Gentile overlord. And he delivered you in fulfillment of a promise, Genesis 15. Well, here's a generation that has their own set of promises. Daniel 9, there's a 70-year clock ticking in Daniel. And so here you got these Jewish people in Israel. They've got a promise that at a certain time God's going to, and here they are at Passover celebrating the last time God delivered you from a Gentile power. And everybody's thinking about, no, it's time for it to happen again. This is not going to make the Romans sleep easy. That's what I'm trying to say. Does that make sense to you? So think about what it means that on Passover, not on the day of Passover, but during Passover week, Jesus rides into the town and the whole city rejoices and welcomes him as a king. Do you remember a guy named Jehu in the Old Testament? Jehu, who became king of the northern kingdom. And he was actually a general in the army of Ahab. And he was off fighting in Ramoth-Gilead. And Elisha sent a son of the prophet to go and tell him he was going to be king. So the prophet goes over there and tells him, we're done with Ahab. You're going to be the next king. And as soon as the prophet says you're going to be the king, what do all of Jehu's men do? This is Second Kings, about chapter 9, I think. They throw their garments down. That's what you do. When you throw your garments down to welcome a king, you're subjecting yourself to him. Well, here's the question, and it's a legitimate question. And I'm amazed, on the one hand, that it is so often addressed, but I'm chagrined, on the other hand, by the way I hear it addressed. The question is, how did Jesus get away with it? How did he ride into the city of Jerusalem? The Romans had extra forces. They had soldiers disguised as peasants throughout the crowd, just looking for any sort of seditious whisper. Jesus rides in, the whole city welcomes him as king, and he goes in, looks in the temple, and goes back. How did he get away with that? There's an interesting video that was done by a fine ministry, but it's a horrible video, in which they have three New Testament professors of some repute over in Jerusalem. They gussied it up. But at any rate, they're asking this question specifically. And this is the answer they come to. They say, well, you know, you got to understand, it was a different day. And probably what happened was that, and they say, you know, when you're part of something, it looks bigger than it really is because it's Passover. And there are thousands and tens of thousands of people. And they're all dancing and singing. And the disciples come in with Jesus. And they look out and they think, oh, they must be dancing for Jesus. They were just dancing because it was Passover. And so it was probably just a little group of 30 or 40 people. They don't give the number, but it's just a little group. And but the disciples were kind of, they were mistaken about what was going on. So it wasn't that big a deal. And so the Romans didn't care. Well, I'll tell you what. Number one, that's exactly what the Romans were looking for. 30, 40 people over in the corner. They'd be on that like nobody's business. But the other problem is, that's not what the Bible says. Folks, don't spend any time trying to rescue the Bible from itself, okay? Don't think, oh, that doesn't work. I better come up with some crazy explanation as to why. Just take the Bible for what it says. What does the Bible say? It says Jesus rode into the city, and the whole city. See, I'll just tell you up front, this is the answer to the question, how did he get away with it? Matthew gives us the whole city was moved with his coming. And that's what tied the hands of Jesus' enemies, both Jewish and Roman. In fact, what are you going to arrest the whole city? If it had been just 30 or 40 people, they'd have been on it. But the whole city, there was nothing else going on. But how came the whole city to do that? And by the way, let me show you one other thing here real quickly. There's an interesting verse in John 12. In John's telling of the triumphal entry. That's where we are in John's telling, John 12 and verse 12. He says, this is what I want you to see. He says, the next day, a great multitude who had come to the feast, here, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. Well, how did they hear? And commentators stumble. We don't know how they heard. No, I think we know how they heard. So now I get to the meat of what I want to talk about. Let me take you back to this map, or to this power. Now watch this. So I'm answering the question. No, I don't want to say it that way. I believe the Bible answers for us the question, how did Jesus get away with it? And I think it gives us a marvelous example of what it meant for Jesus to be as wise as a serpent, clever, resourceful, So this is what happened. And I said to you before the break, just in passing, that I think it's deliberate that Jesus had established for himself standing in Samaria. Do you remember? Now, here we are just before the Feast of Passover. 6 months before, late 32, there was another feast. It's called the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus went up to that feast in John chapter 7. Do you remember it says in John chapter 7 that his brothers didn't believe in him, and they went down to the feast, and then it says after they left, Jesus went, as it were, secretly. I think the point is he went through Samaria. Nah, that's not going to make sense right now, but it will in a minute, so let me come back to it. So, Jesus is in Ephraim. All right, so let me just do this here. See if you can you see that? Here's little Ephraim right here. So, and I just made that up, okay? I just penciled it in. It's about there. It's just about 5 miles north and a little bit west of Jerusalem, right on the way of the patriarchs. But at any rate, now I want you to understand that, though. I don't want to go past that. Jesus at Ephraim, which is north of Jerusalem. All right, now let's get our bearings here. We've already talked about this. You got Judea. To the north, you got Samaria. To the north of that, you've got Galilee. By the way, too many by the ways. Most Jews at this time lived in Galilee. See, when the Jews came back under Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple and under Nehemiah to rebuild the city and so on, they settled right around the temple, right around, just in the hills around Jerusalem. But it had gotten too crowded. And about 120 years before Christ, the Hasmoneans had gone up and they had conquered and annexed Galilee. Now, Galilee is where the good living is, okay? I cite this all the time, but the rabbis say that it's easier to raise 10 sons in Galilee than one vineyard in Judea. And it's true. Galilee, a lot of water, beautiful flat plains, rolling hillsides, wide open. You can put a road anywhere. You can have villages everywhere. Judea is steep and tight, and you can't store the water, and it's hard to travel. So the Jews had largely migrated up to Galilee. That's why, and Jesus was a Galilean. And that's why his family were, remember, both Mary and Joseph were from Bethlehem, but they lived in Nazareth. That's part of that huge migration. It took place about 100 years. And that's why Jesus gave so much of his ministry to Galilee. Because if you're going to make yourself, if you're going to offer yourself to the Jews, you got to go where they are. And they were in Galilee. Now, remember, the Bible, Luke says that Joseph, Jesus' adopted father, would take his family to Passover every year. So Jesus knew the habits of the Galilean Jews. Now watch this. You have this area to the north called Galilee. It's dominant. I want you to, this. I love to talk about this, but that arrowhead that that's the Jezreel Valley. It's the most important valley on the face of the earth, but in terms of historical struggles there. But it is the southern reaches of Galilee. So and then all of these villages, hundreds of villages all throughout Galilee, where tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Galileans live. Now the point is, I say it again, Jesus knew the habits of the Galilean Jews. And this is what they would do. They would gather down into the Jezreel Valley. Then watch this. Can you see this? There were two routes by which they might make their way down to Jerusalem. All right? Now get this. I'm telling you. One is called the Ridge, R-I-D-G-E, route. Because it stays up on the ridges and it follows. Now, that's what Ephraim, Samaria, Galilee, I'm sorry, Judea in the south. It's all these steep ridges. That is steep, V-shaped valleys, rugged hillsides, very hard to travel. So travel has to be on the ridge. And ridges, a lot of the ridges don't go anywhere. So you need to know which ridge. And they connect and they go through a valley and a pass and so on. But there's one route. It's called the Way of the Patriarch because this is the way. Look. When we leave Jerusalem and we head north to go up to Shiloh, this is the route we take. The same route. Now, it's modern roads. They can shape it a little better and so on. But you got to stay on this ridge. You always did. So there was this route called the Ridge Route. It was about 65 miles. In terms of that day, it was by light years the route you want to take. It's the most direct. It's the easiest and so on. But the problem is it passes through Samaria. And Samaria was horribly dangerous at this time, especially at feast seasons. They would fall upon pilgrims and Passover pilgrims and beat them and so on. I mean, it was ugly. So there was an alternate route. Now watch this. It's called the, I know it's close, but it's very different, R-I-F-T, the Rift Route, because this right here is the Jordan Rift, and it's the deepest defile on the face of the earth, all right? So, by the way, for instance, it starts up here between the Lebanon and Lebanon Mountains and makes its way down like this, all the way down and then further south. But in Israel, it's basically the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. The Sea of Galilee, you know, just real quick, the lowest spot in America is what? It's Death Valley. Do you know what it is? I happen to know because I do this all the time. You know how much below sea level? Pardon me? About 280. What I read is 282, precisely. The Sea of Galilee is 600 feet below sea level on its surface. The Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level on its surface, and it's 1,200 feet deep. So this is the deepest gash on the face of the earth. It's actually called the Syro-African Rift because it goes from Syria all the way down to Central Africa. And it's about a sixth of the earth's circumference, just a huge, huge tectonic plate gash. You want to have a really profitable time in Israel, you need to go with Wayne Deckard along, I'll tell you, because, man, he's come with me twice, and I learned as much as anybody does on a trip just because he does geology all along the way. And this is geology rich, wouldn't you say, Wayne, this area down here. But we even found some dinosaur tracks over there one time just because Wayne was along, so we thought we'd. But at any rate, the point, we didn't go looking for them. They were on display. But the point is that, so here is the other route. Now, I say that because you're going to leave, again, we're not going to, the ridge route is usually impassable. So the other route, same thing, they gather down. See, here's the thing, whichever route you take, it's going to be dangerous. So you never do it just in families. You always gather in bands of Passover pilgrims. And that might be neighborhoods, it might be just, but a couple 300 people making their way along, and the men are on the outside, and the women are on the inside with the kids and so on. You make your way down and so on, because you're watching. You got to be able to protect yourself. This will help you with the story in Luke chapter 2, where it says Mary and Joseph set out, and they both thought Jesus to be in the company. Remember that? So Mary thought he was with the, and turns out, and at night you make camp with your family and so on, and in that case, I always say they lost the Messiah. This is no good. But the point is that, so either way, you're not going to travel alone. You're going to have a large group. Now watch what happens. They would go down the Harod Valley, this arrowhead, the arrowhead itself called the Jezreel Valley, and the shaft here of the arrow is the Harod Valley, for what it's worth. But it makes an immediate passage through the hills over to Perea. So they would make their way down the Harod Valley, cross the Jordan Rift, because that was the border of Samaria, and then make their way down the 55 miles or so to Jericho, reford the river, and now they're climbing up the backside of the Mount of Olives on the east side of Jerusalem. Three times in the Old Testament, the Mount of Olives is called the mountain which lies on the east of Jerusalem. It's a north-south ridge of mountains, it's higher than Jerusalem. And so when you come to Jerusalem from Jericho, from the east, you're going to come up the backside of that mount, and then you're going to crest the Mount of Olives and walk down into Jerusalem. Does that make sense to you? Now, that's the normal route. All right, so those are the two routes. And, let me say that we know dead sure that the route that Jesus is going to take in this instance is the rift route. He's going to come down through Jericho because it's a Jericho that he heals the two blind men and has lunch with Zacchaeus. That's on this trip. All right, so here we are. This is what I want you to see. The Bible says, all right, now watch, folks. This is where we got to get real deliberate about harmonizing. Because John says that Jesus, after raising Lazarus from the dead, went to the village of Ephraim. Now we're going to pick that story up. Luke picks the story up. And Luke has him setting out for Jerusalem. And notice what it says, and this has befuddled a lot of commentators and so on, but right here it says, it came to pass as he went to Jerusalem. Where is he? He's in Ephraim. Ephraim is just north of Jerusalem. As he went to Jerusalem, he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Now you see the problem? If you go to Samaria and Galilee, you got Jerusalem in the rearview mirror. You're just north of Jerusalem. You head straight north to get to Jerusalem. Why? And most most versions, and I've compared a lot of them, but I won't take you through it, but a lot of them will mess with this, and they'll say something like, what does the ESV say? You got John, Luke 17:11? I think it says something like, passed along the border of, or something like that.
I've got
between Samaria and Galilee. Along between. And all of that is an attempt to make some sense of the geographic reality that if you go through Samaria and Galilee. Now, it could not be more explicit. I give you the King James here, because that's, after all, the real Bible. No, I'm teasing. But no, I don't want to go there, do I? But I love the King James. But the point is that it's a good translation, both by nominal word ending and by reinforced by preposition. What he says is, he passed through the midst of, the heart of Samaria and Galilee. Why would he do this? Well, let's just accept that he did it. And so here is his route. Jesus is in Ephraim, and he passed through the midst of Samaria. And I think that naturally is to, the way you need to take that is he got on the ridge route and he went north. Now remember that there would be very few Jewish folk. Remember, there's a price on his head. He's a fugitive, but he's not going to be under any concern in Samaria. And because he had established standing for himself back there in John chapter 4 early in his ministry, this is the fourth time he passes through Samaria at a season when Jews aren't able to go there. Now, one of those times, by the way, one of the Samaritans, the villages, won't receive him, and John and James want to call fire down. Remember that? But what did Jesus do? He went to the next Samaritan village. It's really astounding that Jesus had that kind of standing in Samaria, and I think it was because he had affected it through that ministry in Sychar. But the point is that he makes his way through Samaria and Galilee and into Galilee. Now, I think probably what he did was just make his way into the Jezreel Valley there, which is very much the heart of Galilee. And that is where these bands of Passover pilgrims will gather to make their way down the Herod Valley. And I think Jesus fell in with one of those bands. And now he, and I picture it this way. I have kind of fun with it. I picture them making their way down maybe the Herod Valley, and they can look up, that they're going down to the Jordan Rift, so they're going pretty much east, and they can look to the south and hear the hills of Samaria, and maybe some band of Passover pilgrims, and they're on the watch because they're in skirting Samaritan territory. So somebody looks up there and says, "Hey, what's going on up there? There are 13 guys. This could be trouble, you know." And then maybe as those guys come down out of the hills, get a little closer, they begin to say, "You know what? Those are not Samaritans. They don't have Samaritan dress on. Those are Galileans. What's going on here?" And then maybe one of them says, "Wait a minute, I think I recognize that guy in the middle. Isn't that the Nazarene, for heaven's sake?" So now he comes down and joins your band, your group, as you make your way down to the Passover. And all along the way, and folks, it's interesting, and I haven't got time to develop this over much at all, but for 6 months, only John and Luke tell the story. The Matthew and Mark drop out. But Matthew and Mark both re-enter the narrative here. And they tell us in great detail what happens as Jesus travels with these probably several hundred Galilean Jews who are making their way down to Passover and who have been and are very excited about the fact that they've been joined by Jesus and his disciples. And all along the way, he is teaching. This is Matthew 19 when he challenges the Pharisees. I don't think he challenges them to their face, probably, but he challenges their teaching on divorce. This is the rich young ruler when he comes. What must I do to be saved? This is the 10 lepers. It's along this trip that 10 lepers come and Jesus heals them and only one comes back. All that happens on this trip. As a matter of fact, when he gets to Jericho, he encounters two blind men. Remember that? And he heals them. Then, and this is so important, you see, I believe that at this point, Jesus is being very much the provocateur. He's trying to get a lot of excitement. Now, he comes to Jericho, and he sees a somewhat diminutive tax collector up in a tree, and he says, "Zacchaeus, come down. I'm going to your house." Now, you can't imagine how the crowd, what? He's going to the house of a tax? Does he know anything? So everybody's excited. Jesus is doing miracles. This trip is probably going to take at least 4 days. It's about 120 miles. That's one of the problems. If you take the ridge route, it's about 90 miles. I'm sorry, it's about 60 miles. Okay, I got to back up. I got that wrong. It's about 60 miles if you start in the Jezreel Valley and take the ridge right down to Jerusalem. It's about 90 miles if you go down to the rift. And the last leg of the rift travel is hideous because you're down at the Jordan Rift, which is 1,300 feet below sea level, and you got to climb up to the top of the Mount of Olives, which is 2,700 feet above sea level, and it's about 12 miles. So remember, Jesus talked about a man who went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. You're flat going down. And so it's a much more difficult route, but you take this route because Samaria is off limits. But my point is, for maybe 4 days, Jesus has been traveling with these people. And they're all excited, and they're watching these miracles. And I think, I would say, if I was in the next group back, and the word came back that the Nazarene was up there, I'm going to hot foot it up. I imagine this group is growing and growing. So now, here he comes, and he's coming up that last leg. And John, this is where we got to harmonize. John says, John chapter 12, I never got him home. So he's going to make his way down. This is the route he would have traveled with the Passover pilgrims. That make sense to you? Jericho is right down here. So he's going to cross through Jericho and so on. Now, at this point, we go back to John. And John says that 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany. Now, you got to understand, Bethany is, all right, I said to you before, you're going to make your way from Jericho down in the rift, up that steep incline, all the way up to the top of Mount of Olives, then you're going to walk down across the Kidron and into Jerusalem. Just before you crest the Mount of Olives, on the back side, the eastern side, just before you, there's a road that goes off to the south, to Bethany. It's there today. Now, you can't follow it. In days gone by, we've done this. We've gone to Bethany and walked our way up and so on. There's a wall there now. You can't do it. You got to go to Jericho to get to Bethany from Jerusalem. But the point is that you can see the road going. So here we are, several hundred people. We've been traveling with Jesus for days and days, several days, all this excitement. We're on our way to Jerusalem. We're beginning to get very excited just because we're about to enter Jerusalem. And then let me say this. 6 days before the Passover, it's a lot of discussion, but I'm right about this. This is the prevailing view. There are a couple of minor views. 6 days before the Passover is Friday. Passover is Thursday in this year. So, it's Friday. You're making your way up the backside of the Mount of Olives, hundreds of people. You've watched lepers healed. You've watched blind men healed. You've listened to Jesus' teaching. You're all excited. And it's Friday afternoon, and you're making your way up that hillside. And you watch. Remember, Jesus is very much the center of attention here. You watch as Jesus and the 12 wave goodbye, and you see them take that road. You know exactly where they're going. They're going to keep the Sabbath with Lazarus. But you don't want to go to Bethany. There's nothing in Bethany for you. So you hurry on into the city of Jerusalem. What is everybody in Jerusalem standing around asking one another? See the point? That's why it's so important. Is he going to come? And on Friday afternoon, sometime on Friday, several hundred people make their way into Jerusalem. They've been with Jesus for several days. And the question before the house, the question that is sort of animating quietly the city is, do you think Jesus will even come for the Passover? And I have on your sheets there, actually something to write in. I would argue that on Friday afternoon, hundreds of pilgrims, Passover pilgrims, entered the city, and they entered the city bearing two messages. Now, okay, before I tell you this, I got to tell you one other point. It's huge. There is a rabbinical and probably somewhat legitimate prohibition against walking more than a Sabbath day's journey. You've heard this, right? So on Sabbath, Saturday, you're only supposed to walk. It's about a mile and two-fifths for what it's worth. And understand, it's a zone. You can move around in the zone. The point is you can't, and the rabbis were so careful about this that they would actually mark from the center of a walled city. They'd go out in all the major roads and they'd put a marker. Here's the mile and two-fifths. Now, if you're inside that marker, when the sun goes down on Friday, you can move around and so on, but you can't leave the city. If you're outside, you can't come in the city until sundown on Saturday. Does that make sense to you? And the reason I think that may be appropriate or important is because a lot of these pilgrims very possibly have never been to Jerusalem. Most Jews only got to Passover once or twice in their lives, even if they lived close by. But we can talk about that another time. But even if you had never been to Jerusalem before, you watch as Jesus goes off to Bethany. You go a little further. Here's the marker for the Sabbath day zone. And then you go into the city. And I think you're bearing two messages. One is, Jesus is coming. We know he's coming. We've been traveling with him. He's coming to the feast. Can you imagine how exciting this is? But the second message is, get this, he'll be here Sunday morning. Why? Because he stopped in Bethany. Now, he's not going to come down after Saturday. You don't do things after the sun goes down, and the Sabbath's not over till the sun goes down. So he's coming to the feast. He went to Bethany for the Sabbath. He'll be here Sunday morning. And now, and remember, we've already been told that the city is rather abuzz with this question. Do you think he'll come? And now that message begins to circulate through the city. Now, this is where I started out with you, folks. Jesus made that promise, you'll not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the Lord. We say, it's not going to happen. It did happen. And I read you that verse in John 12 when it says, the people who had heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. And I would argue that Jesus, he knew the habits of the Galilean Jews. He timed his steps so that he tarried in Ephraim until he went up, joined in with one of them, came down, timed it so he would arrive on Friday afternoon and let them go into the city. And there's no miracle here. It's just a really, really wise as a serpent Jesus who allows those people to go into the city. And here's, I think, what happened. Think about it. This is Passover. As I said earlier, every Jewish heart is beating with thoughts of sedition. Oh, how we like to be under this Roman, up from under this Roman. And we got a promise. We got a 70-year clock started ticking about 70 years ago. There in a 490-year clock, 70-week clock is what I'm trying to say. But the point is Daniel 9 is about to be fulfilled. There's no doubt about that. And so they I think this is what happened. Here come these hundreds of people, and they're all excited, and they got stories to tell, and they're anxious to tell them. And the city is abuzz with the question, is Jesus coming? So all these pilgrims get, I like to say, they're Warholian 15 minutes, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's their 15 minutes of fame. And so house by house, neighborhood by neighborhood, it begins, the Nazarene is coming. He's coming. And he'll be here Sunday morning. And I think without any orchestration, without any concert, without any announcements on the internet or whatever, you know what I'm saying? There's only one road that comes from Bethany. Well, let's just go welcome him. So now on Sunday morning, people who are sick, and listen, the other thing is too, I mentioned that we're sick of the Roman, the Roman yoke is unbearable. And it's especially odious here in Israel. And we're a people who, we're God's people. This is wrong. And by the way, not only do you have that 70 week clock ticking, but remember that you also have those prophecies in Daniel 2 and 7 that there will be four empires. What's the fourth empire? It's Rome. Why not? This could be it, folks. And so I think everybody is thinking, oh, we are so tired of Rome. And we've got prophecies. And here you have this Nazarene. What do you think? Can you still use the phrase degrees of separation? That was worked in our generation. But I don't know. But what could have been the degrees of separation between anybody in Israel and somebody who had been healed by Jesus? Could there be anybody who didn't have a second cousin or a neighbor down the road who couldn't see all of his life and now is, you know what I'm saying? So here are all these people who have come to Jerusalem for the Passover. It says that in John 12. And they know of this Jesus. And they know it's they've got biblical promises, they've got Daniel, and they've got Lazarus. Folks, if you had to go to battle against some hideously powerful enemy, it would be an encouragement to follow somebody who could raise you from the dead, for heaven's sakes? Would that give you a certain amount of abandon in the effort? You see what I'm saying? So I think the point is that Jesus deliberately orchestrated the city's reception. And the city erupted in happy welcome. And that's the answer as to how he got away with it, as we said before. So I'm saying that you go back to Luke 13. He makes an unthinkable promise. And then you trace his steps. It's in the Bible. I haven't made anything up. It's all in the Bible. And it fits together in such a way as we understand that Jesus rode into the city on that Sunday morning to present himself as Messiah. Now, on the next page, I give you some notes concerning the triumphal entry itself. And let's just talk about that. And, yes, please. By yeah, anybody got a question? I'd love to feel it. Yeah. That's right. He's able to take the ridge route to the north. Blame Ephraim and then going north. Ephraim, listen, when you're thinking about travel in the New Testament, the average, they would say, is about 25 miles a day walking. Now, that's assuming you don't have a huge crowd and a lot of baggage and so on. So Jesus probably could have made the trip up to Galilee, up to the Jezreel Valley in 2 to 3 days. But I think he had timed it so that once he joined one of those groups making their way down, that they would be there. It would take them about 4 days because it's a lot longer to go down, and it's a lot more crowded. So it's about half again as long, about 90 miles, and it's about twice as difficult a route going the rift route. That's right. He passed through the midst of Samaria on the ridge route and into Galilee on the ridge route. Well said. Yes, he's coming up from Jericho. And we know that because, again, Matthew and Mark are telling us the story here of this trip. In John... Yes, yes, yes. In Ephraim, when he goes to Ephraim, he has parked himself right on the ridge route. That makes sense to you? Geography can help, I'm telling you. All right, anything else? All right, let me take you then. I know you're getting sleepy, and I don't blame you a bit, but let me just take you very quickly through page 8, and I'm not going to spend just a moment with this. Folks, I want to say again, I have called this a day of messianic presentation, and honest to goodness, you know, throughout his life, and this is one of those 10 points of those insights. It's very, very helpful. I'll say it very quickly. Throughout his ministry, Jesus made two claims concerning himself. He claimed to be the Messiah, and he claimed to be God come in the flesh. Now, I'm not just arbitrarily identifying those two. They show up at least 4 times in the gospel record. First of all, when Jesus gets his disciples up to Caesarea Philippi area and gives them what I call their oral examination for their undergraduate work, that's what I like to call it, because he's got graduate work for them next, and it's a one-question exam, whom do you say that I am? And they say, what? What does Peter say? Thou art the Christ, that means Messiah, the Son of the living God. That's what Jesus, and Jesus was, he just rejoices. Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah. Because, understand this too, and I'll say it just in passing, that those two claims are beyond what we can easily appreciate, difficult to believe. They are incredible in the most formal sense of the word. Jesus' claim to be Messiahship was an unspeakable disappointment. We are looking for a war. You want to know how desperately disappointing Jesus was as a Messiah to the expectations of that generation. Think about John the Baptist. John the Baptist saw the dove descend, heard the voice from heaven, announced this is Jesus, this is Messiah. But when John finds himself in a Roman prison and Messiah Jesus doesn't do anything about it, he sends messengers saying, are you the Messiah or aren't you, for heaven's sakes? Remember that? What in the world's going on there? Well, John just didn't know what to do with that. If I'm the forerunner and he's the Messiah and some pagan king has thrown me in prison because I got after him for his wickedness and Jesus doesn't do anything about it? So, number one, he claimed to be Messiah. Now, I'm not saying it was wrong to expect a warrior Messiah, but first of all, there would be a suffering Messiah. That was what was tough. But secondly, he claimed to be God come in the flesh. And as I said this morning, it's too easy for us to just let that roll off our tongues. But folks, in fact, Jesus' claim to be deity is high-handed blasphemy of the most awful sort by Mosaic standards. Unless it just happens to be the truth. And never before in human history had it been the truth. And think about this. Okay, you're sleepy, but just think about this for a minute. This is an important insight, I think. What is it that is most important in terms of evidence that proves Jesus claimed to be God? In your mind, your heart, your life, Paul's theology, What is it that more than anything else proves Jesus' claim to be God come in the flesh? What is it? It's the resurrection. They didn't have the resurrection. They had a Nazarene. He was a man. He was a stonemason. Many of them had known him all of his life. And all of a sudden, he didn't glow in the dark. He didn't have a halo, for heaven's sakes. He was a man. And all of a sudden, he starts claiming to be God. This is staggering, beyond what you can imagine almost. Now, I say, you have that in Matthew 16, thou art the Christ, the living God, when Jesus feeds the 5,000 and then preaches the sermon and everybody goes back and he says to his disciples, you're going to go back. And they say, who are we going to go? You're the words of life. We know, we have come to believe you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. That formula, the Christ, the Son of the living God. When Martha got after Jesus, remember Jesus had come to, Lazarus was dead and Martha's saying, oh, if you would have been here, he wouldn't have died. No, he's going to live again. Of course, I'm going to live again the resurrection. I want him now. No. I am the resurrection of life. Do you believe this? In that emotionally supercharged moment, what erupts out of Martha's heart when Jesus simply says, do you believe I'm the resurrection? Is, Master, I believe you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, that's the formula. And then John writes a gospel. And he carefully selects certain signs to record. And he says, other signs Jesus did, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and that believing, you might have life through his name, right? So this is what Jesus demanded that you believe, that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, again, as you contemplate, I just want to make the point that those are horribly difficult to believe, especially this idea that he's the God, very God. Time out real quickly. Folks, it is my experience, both experience, that is, with others and with myself, that I think Christians just kind of quietly, I want to say stagger, but are a little bit confused or off-put by the phrase Son of God. And here again, you gotta learn to read the Bible in terms of that culture. And I think I've said this to you before, but when we think of son, we think of first-generation male offspring. That's what a son is, right? So I got one son, his name is Jonah. I got one grandson, his wife had a boy last Thursday. But the point is that to that's a son. Well, not in Hebrew culture. I keep saying in Hebrew culture, all right, I'm looking around the room now. So here are three boys. To whom do these belong? All right, now, how old are you guys? I'm sorry? 13? How are you? 11? And how about the youngest one? 9? So now, 9, 11, 13. Yeah, these are switched. Yeah. There's a. All right. Now, here's the thing. If I were to ask, what is it? Helen. If I were to say, Helen. Kelly. If I were to say Helen, she wouldn't pay me any heed. But if I were to say, Kelly, how many sons do you have? In a Jewish setting, what would her answer be, do you know? 3. Generally, bar mitzvah is going to be at about 12 or 13. So let's say that the middle son has been bar mitzvahed. That makes him a son. The other two are boys. When they are bar mitzvahed, formally now, you might use the word colloquially otherwise, but formally, what the word actually means in that culture is, he is a, when you have a child, when you have a male child, he's a boy. He grows up and is bar mitzvahed, and as bar mitzvah, he becomes a son. Now, that is so big and so central to Jewish culture that it just, there are so many ways in which that kind of, in terms of word pictures and so on, enters the drama of Scripture, Old and New Testament. But one of the most important dynamics, guys, pay attention to this because you'll want to run with this, is that, no, it really doesn't work in our culture, forgive me. That's my whole point. This is a different culture. When a boy is bar mitzvahed, he is to be treated as the equal of his father. He has the same standing, the same responsibilities, the same stature as his father. He is the equal of his father. Now, that idea is so, I don't know if I want to say central, but it's so redolent in the idea of sonship that all throughout the scriptures, Old and New Testament, again and again, son of means one with or equal to or to be identified with. Judas is the son of perdition. It has nothing to do with his parents. It just means he is bound for perdition. He's one with it. Jesus said to his generation, you build these monuments to the prophets and you want to say that you wouldn't have killed the prophets if you've been alive, but you go about to kill me. And in so doing, you prove you are indeed the sons of your fathers. Now, nobody was disputing if they were the genealogical sons of their fathers. The issue was, are they equal to their fathers? That make sense to you? And nobody ever heard Jesus claiming to be the offspring of God when he talked about himself. And by the way, Jews would not crucify a man for claiming to be created by God, okay? They heard him claiming to be one with the Father. That's what son of means. That make sense to you? So I go way back to it. For Jesus to claim to it. All right, so I'm going to leave that alone. My point is simply this. Jesus rides into the city, and the city explodes in happy welcome. And, all right, let's just talk about this. There are three, I give them to you there. I'm going to go through them very quickly. There are three lines of Old Testament predictive promise which really come together. The first is Zechariah 9:9, and this is quoted by Matthew as being fulfilled. And I want you to see this because it really is kind of a very instructive, hold on here, I'm going to go over to Zechariah 9:9. There is that about this verse and the way it plays out here, which I think isn't very much appreciated. Zechariah 9, you're familiar with this, and verse 9, let's see if it give it to me, it won't. Rejoice, O greatly, daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is come to you. Now watch. He is coming to you. He is just and having salvation. Now, he is lowly and riding on a donkey. Now, this is it really is kind of amazing. The fact is, most people identify the lowly and the donkey. I don't think so. I don't think the donkey is the lowly part. Because in antiquity, in this culture, kings rode on donkeys. All right? It was a royal steed, if you don't mind. I've seen various explanations. The one that makes the most sense to me is that if you're on a stallion, a war horse, it would suggest maybe you weren't entirely in charge. If you're on a donkey, that can't be used in battle, so everything's taken care of. However you like it, Absalom gets on David's donkey and rides through the city when he rebels and so on. So now, the point, though, I think, is this. What's striking is as it says, lowly and riding on a donkey. Folks, what would you expect when a king comes riding into a town? You'd expect heralds and trumpets and military accoutrements and all sorts of banners and so on. There's none of that. There's none of that. Jesus just rides lowly. He's as humble as can be. Now, I think the donkey, now, it wouldn't be particularly distinctive. There'd be other people on donkeys, but it is true that kings ride on donkeys, so it may have been a quiet, non-incendiary a claim to royalty. But at any rate, it's really stunning that Jesus rode in quietly, none of the accoutrements of royalty or military celebration, anything like that, and yet the whole city. But that's exactly what happened, as described there. The second line, and I'm not going to spend any time with this, of prophetic, I've mentioned it a couple of times. I give you, no, I don't either. Yeah, I do right there. All right, I'm going to say very quickly, and I think you've studied this here before, and I know there's a lot of discussion and disagreement even among good Bible believers. But, and I am kind of a disciple of Harold Honer here, though I've fine-tuned it a little bit to his dismay. But, because I did this in a class I took from him. But the point is that in Daniel 9, a prophecy is made that says, from the going forth of a certain command unto Messiah the Prince will be, when you work it through all the language and so on, will be 69 cycles of 7 years, and that is 483 years. And the decree at stake seems to be that given to Nehemiah in Nehemiah 1, which was Nisan 1444. And if you start on that decree and go forward It's 77, 69, 7. So what do I want to say? 300, 483 would be 490. Yeah, okay. My mind had a brain burp. 483 years. You count forward 483 years, if they're the years that I think they are. And it comes out to March 29, 33 AD. Now, I think, and I think it's interesting that when Jesus entered the city, he prayed over it and he said, he wept over it and said, Jerusalem, if only you had known what belonged to you on this thy day. And remember the prophecy or the instruction of Psalm 118, this is the day which the Lord has made. So I think maybe the moment, now listen, I say, there's so much discussion about this, and it gets kind of technical, and at that point, I don't even want to talk about it, because I don't want to spend quite that much time on it, but with all the days and the calendars and all that sort of thing. But I will say this, I think it is absolutely undeniable that God had narrowed the season to just a few months. And so they knew that within this period, you know, I have a good friend over in Israel, I've got to be done, Menno Kalischer. Pastors a church over there, and he has for several years been running an evangelistic campaign or of sorts, a project, and he made a really nice, you can get it online, a nice brochure, many, you know, several colors and so on, of Daniel chapter 9. And he just walks, now you got to understand, Jewish people don't read their Bible, you know that, right? They're totally unfamiliar with this. But he just says, now go to your Bible, go to Daniel 9, and trace what it says, and he says, by any configuration, that prophecy had to come to pass somewhere in the first half of the first century of this era. Somewhere in that time. And then he simply says, if it's not Jesus of Nazareth, who is it? Because it had to happen right there. So you tell me who it is if it's not Jesus of Nazareth. And I think it's just a telling, the Old Testament prophesied the manner of his coming. He'll be lowly, riding on a donkey. And I think the moment of his coming, perhaps to the day, but at least to the season. And then most importantly, and this is where I'm going to leave you. We're going to pick it up here tomorrow night. We're going to make a lot of progress. But the third area of I thought I had it here. Well, at any rate, yeah, this is what we already talked about. Sorry about that. Oh, I want to talk about one other thing. Oh, I got it. Give me 5 minutes, I swear. The third area of prophetic promise was the meaning of his coming. And there I'm going to where the psalm had taught them to cry out, save now. That this was, in fact, the appearance of that long-awaited deliverer from the curse of sin. First of all, anticipated, happily enough, in Genesis 3, the seed of the woman who would crush the skull of the tempter, right? That's and then they were taught, when he appears, you cry out, save now. This is your deliverer. All right, so I would say Jesus rides into the city on Sunday morning. The city having been prepared, his having alerted the city through all of these hundreds of people. And I think it's not insignificant that they came in on Friday, so you have kind of a whole Saturday for this message that Jesus is coming to percolate through the city. So now on Sunday morning, Jesus sends his disciples just up the hill from Bethany there a little ways to another village called Bethphage and says there's a donkey there. They secure the donkey. He gets on the donkey. They start to, and I imagine if I'm one of the 12 apostles and I know that Jesus is a fugitive, there's so much anger and so on. And here I am. It's a Sunday morning. Sunday is Monday. It's busy morning and so on. But here we are making our way up the hill. The backside and just on the other side, we can't see anything yet, is the vast temple spread out before us and so on. And all of a sudden you start to hear a lot of commotion. What's going on over there? Man. And you know there's a price on Jesus' head. And you're thinking probably, oh, this is probably it. We're probably in trouble now. They got the forces out. We're going to be in such trouble. And then you march over the hill and here are tens and hundreds of thousands of people throwing down their garments and waving palm branches and crying Hosanna and blessed be he who comes in the name of the Lord and so on. Can you imagine? By the way, this week is going to be the most unimaginable emotional roller coaster. It staggers me when I think about it. You know, for several weeks, Jesus has been talking about dying. You don't want to hear about this. You don't know what Now you ride into the city of Jerusalem. You're thinking, I don't know what that dying talk is, but this is a good thing. Here, we are on a roll. We're on some kind of roll. And it's going to get better, because in the morning on Monday, we'll talk about this tomorrow, he's going to come back to the city and cleanse the temple and then possess it for 2 days. Behave more messianically than he ever does in his whole life. And you're thinking, oh, here we are. And then you have a quiet day on Wednesday, and then on Thursday you go to keep... And by the way, this is getting ahead of myself. He arranges, you don't know it, he keeps it secret, but he arranges to have the Passover supper in the most expensive gated community in all of Jerusalem, in one of the finest houses, a huge villa on the Western Hill. At Jerusalem, at Passover, literally hundreds of thousands of pilgrims would come. It's interesting to study the way the Jewish laws of hospitality were expected to be fulfilled. You were expected to, every square inch of your house you gave over to people. And they were hanging from the rafters in every house, people you didn't know. If they're pilgrims, you come up. But most people couldn't get into homes. There wasn't enough room. And so they bring tents. And they lived in tents. Tents were huge. Everybody had a tent. They were very used to living in tents. And all the Bible said was that when the Passover, you had to have the Passover lamb slain at the temple, and then you had to eat, you had to go inside and eat it in sight of the temple. In sight of the temple. So you have all these hills around here, and they would, and Jerusalem is kind of a bowl with all of these higher hills all around, so they would just be covered with people. And I'm sure the disciples thought that's what they do. They didn't live here. So they probably had brought their tents, and they'll think, well, we'll pitch a tent, we'll go in and keep the Passover. Now Jesus takes them up on Thursday afternoon to this I think probably most of the apostles had never been in a house that nice. Again, which if I'm on the apostles, I'm thinking, we are on a roll here. It's about to happen. And then you keep the feast, and all of a sudden Jesus says, come on, we get it out of here. And you go over to Gethsemane, and he weeps, and you sleep, and then he gets up, and he gets arrested. And you scatter, and the next morning, you can't believe it. You watch as he's hung on a tree. I think those apostles fully expect he's coming down. I know he's coming down. It's not going to happen. He won't let this happen. But he dies. Can you imagine the bottomless despair? We had entrusted him, and we know there was no hope whatever. Those two disciples on the road to Emmaus, we thought. They use the past tense. Remember that? We thought he was the Messiah, but he can't be. He's a dead person now. So imagine then on Sunday morning when the word gets out, he's alive. You know what I'm saying? This is an amazing week to live through. But that's not where I was going to go. Let me just say this. Jesus on Sunday rides into the city. I'd love to talk to you about it, but he wouldn't have taken the Eastern Gate, okay? Everybody has him coming in. He didn't go in the Eastern Gate. That's foolish in every way. And besides that, the people would have been down to the south. There was a southern gate that you follow by down the Pool of Siloam, and then you come up that central walkway that some of us explored together and so on. And Jesus would have come all that way. And the Bible says that he went into the temple, looked around, and went back to Bethany. And that's pretty much the triumphal entry. He just comes into town, looks in the temple, goes back, weeps over the city as he leaves the city. That's when he says, oh, if you'd only known. But he goes back to Bethany. Now, let me make two more points here real quickly. I can be quick. Number one, remember he's a fugitive. There is a protocol of Jewish life, of Near Eastern life, ancient Near Eastern life, that it still lives today in many cultures, and that is this, that if I accept you into my home as my guest, I am duty-bound at whatever unimaginable cost it may be to protect you. I will give anything. My life, the life of my family, all that I have. It's just it's an unwritten rule that if I accept you into my home, and by the way, it shows up a couple times in the scriptures and it turns our stomach. First of all, at Lot, at Sodom and Gomorrah, when Lot is willing to give up his city, that's the culture. And then secondly, in Judges 19, the Gibeah experience, when priest with his concubine is in the home and the people are beating the doors down, want to make sport and so on, and they finally toss out the concubine. Remember, but the host offers his daughters. We think, what? That's the culture. This is what's behind, by the way, thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. The point is that I can be absolutely secure because you've accepted me. who do I care what enemies are out there, because you are duty bound. The Lord is down has promised to protect us. Well, that plays into this because you see, Bethany loved Jesus. And Bethany is right on a main road. And it's terribly important that Jesus not be in the absence of the multitude, because if he is, he's going to be seized. So he can make his way out to Bethany, and there are going to be crowds all over. He goes into Bethany, the city of Bethany, and the man Lazarus would die. There would be a major riot if they tried to go out and arrest him in Bethany. Does that make sense to you? So every night he goes to Bethany. It's not accidental. It's not just hospitality at stake. It's protection, and he knows what he's doing. The other thing I need to say is this, and this is just, it's in your notes, but on Saturday night, now just stay with me this real quick. On Saturday night, all right, now, this is explicit in John chapter 12. Jesus comes to Bethany. He keeps the Passover. That's not recorded in John. But then after the Passover, Saturday, as the sun goes down, there happens what is called the going out of Shabbat. Are you Fiddler fans? Do you like Fiddler on the Roof? If not, what in the world's wrong with you, for heaven's sake? Remember, at the beginning of the movie, they're bringing in the Sabbath. Tevye is hurrying, and the horse is lame, and the kids are all getting their, you know, and then they gather, and the candles, and the mother making, that's bringing in the Sabbath. And then you have, that's as the sun goes down on Friday. Then you have a quiet day. As the sun goes down on Saturday, you have the going out of the Sabbath, and what happens, and I like to take people, I mean, it's just entirely cultural, but it's kind of fun, because you can go up to Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem, which is kind of the happening mall street, no traffic and all the shops and so on, and eateries, and you could it's totally deserted at 7 o'clock at night, but by 8 o'clock you can hardly move, because once the sun goes down, everybody, the shops open, the stores open, the musicians come out, and everybody, you know, and it's well into the night. That's the going out of the Sabbath. Well, I think that's what happened. Jesus gets to Bethany on Friday afternoon. The crowd goes on into the city to alert the city that he's coming, but he is going to be there in Bethany, and people in Bethany love Jesus. And I'll tell you something. There, because what I'm saying is that night they have a feast. Now, the feast is where? Do you remember? It's at the home of, this is kind of curious. Remember? No, it's not the home of Mary and it's at the home of Simon the, what is he? Simon the leper. If you get an invitation, you know, come on over, we're going to have a little party at the house of Simon the leper. You going? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think he was healed. Maybe that finger food, you know what I'm saying? But the point is, the point is that I don't know, I'm making this up, but I wonder if Simon, clearly he was a man who had been a leper long enough that was what he was known as, but now he's healed, he somehow, and you could find healing. I think it was essential oils, but no, it's not a thing. But the point is that he hosts and you see, Jesus just a few weeks ago called one of their favorite citizens out of a stinky tomb. So they have a deep affection and regard for this Nazarene. And so as the sun goes down, the word gets out, we need to have a feast. And it's at that feast, this is all I'm going to say. All right, let me just say this. Matthew and Mark tell the story of the feast. Now hear me, in the middle of their Tuesday narrative. And I'll explain to you tomorrow why I think they do. So if you go to Matthew 26 or Mark 14, you have the same story. This is the feast at which Mary anoints Jesus with an unspeakably expensive vial of oil. And everybody gets after her, and Jesus gets after everybody and says, leave her alone. She's done this. This is Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. And I like to say that Jesus had been saying for months that he was going to die. The only person who believed him in the record was Mary. Jesus says, she's done this against the day of my burial. And he says, wherever she's remembered, she's remembered for this. And I don't think just for lavishing the expensive oil, but for actually listening to Jesus when he said, I'm going to die. But the point is that Jesus rebuked everybody, but that rebuke struck deep into the sin-perverted soul spirit of Judas. All right, but that happened on Saturday. Now, I'm telling you, you can read the story in Matthew 26 and Mark 14, and it's in the middle of their Tuesday narrative. They don't put it there. They say they tell it as a flashback when Jesus was. But they have a reason. We'll talk about it tomorrow night as to why they put it where they put it. But John is very careful that night. No, I'm sorry. While he was there in Bethany, they made him a feast. And the next morning, he rides into the city in the triumphal entry. So there's no doubt that this feast happened. So here we are. We're kind of we're making our way toward the Passion Week. So we started back there in Luke 13. Jesus makes a promise to those Pharisees. You're not going to see me till you welcome me as king. Now, some weeks later, he's in Ephraim. No, some weeks later, he raises Lazarus from the dead, makes his way to Ephraim, waits for the appropriate time, makes his way up, gathers with those Passover pilgrims, makes his way down the rift, up the backside of the Mount of Olives, goes to Bethany on Friday, keeps the Sabbath. Saturday night, there's a feast there, and at that feast, you have the rebukes and so on, the anointing and the rebukes. We'll talk a little more about it. And then Sunday morning, Jesus sends his disciples up the hill for that donkey, rides into the city, and you have the triumphal entry, March 29, 33 AD, which I want you to think, if you wouldn't mind, of that as a day of deliberate messianic presentation. Now, and with this, I'm genuinely done. I know I've been promising, but did I tell you my Philippian story? I always, my son got up one time and says, "Dad, you don't know how to quit. You start quitting and it takes you forever. You say you're done, you're not done." Well, my answer is this. How many chapters are there in Philippians? You know? 4. What's the first word in chapter 3? You remember? Finally. But honest to goodness, I am done. Here's the question I want to leave you with, and I have it on that, but we don't have to go there. Very simply, I like to articulate it this way. Given Sunday, why Friday? Given the fact that on Sunday the whole city erupts in happy welcome of and cries out, "Hosanna, be our Savior," why on Friday is that same crowd crying out, "We'll not have this man to reign over us. Crucify him. Give us Barabbas"? Given Sunday, why Friday? We'll talk about that tomorrow night. We'll pick it up there. All right? You want to close, Tim?